This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and on today's show, we continue our producer pick series that takes you behind the scenes of the program. And Laura Pelliser is one of the producers on our show. She is on this side of the studio glass today to share some of her favorite moments from yet another year on the State of Things. Welcome to the State of Things, Laura.
Thank you, Frank. It is a pleasure to be on this esteemed program.
Well, it's great. It is esteemed because of your work. What stood out for you? What are some of the big themes this year?
The big themes this year were a couple of big news stories that are not going anywhere. The two big stories that we covered a lot over 2018 was hurricanes. So a lot of the trauma and the fallout and the recovery processes after Hurricane Florence. We sort of shook up a lot of our program to be able to cover that. And then the other big story has been Silent Sam.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how a bill becomes law here in public radio and our decision to cover the hurricane, because that was obviously it was in flux. We didn't know exactly if we'd even be here and whether we'd be on the air and all of those kind of questions. So, you know, take us behind the scenes. You were filling in actually as managing editor when Florence hit. So tell us, walk us through that decision-making process.
Yeah, so I mean, the first question that we essentially had every day was we were just trying to prioritize the story. So what would happen? What will be the story tomorrow? You know, will the hurricane still be, will the eye still be, you know, on the coast? Mm-hmm. Will we be talking about recovery? Will we be talking about flooding, which was, of course, the case? And we were thinking that every day, you know, the story is the water, the story is not the wind. That was happening. And then we were also making these decisions about, will we be able to get here? Will we have power? So those were some of the things that we were constantly considering. And it was a lot to be juggling, but I think we were able to get a lot of really important stories on air.
And then the question in the immediate aftermath, the Monday following the hurricane, we had to swap out our regular, we decided to actually swap out our regular programming and do a two-hour call-in show that was then networked across the state with partner stations in Charlotte and then, of course, Wilmington and Asheville. And let's hear a clip now that features a licensed professional counselor, Lonnie Crum, as well as a resident of Eastern North Carolina.
And as a therapist, of the clients that I've seen that are already still, that's still in trauma, still experiencing some PTSD, and that's post-traumatic stress dealing with the loss from Hurricane Matthew, the houses and the loved ones, the communities, and this reoccurring trauma. So even before, and even if they aren't, they did not lose or they weren't impacted by the current hurricane, that's that fear, that PTSD, that anxiety that they're overtaken by. So what we have to do as counselors is even check in with them to make sure that there's not this reoccurring trauma happening with those particular residents in Eastern North Carolina and even across the state where we have more flood-prone areas.
Well, I'm going to talk with someone now who is experiencing this even as we speak. Kirsten Crook is back with us. Kirsten was evacuated Boiling Spring Lakes to Atlanta, Georgia, because of Hurricane Florence, but of course has people back there and is in Atlanta now. We spoke with her on Friday, and she joins us again. Kirsten, welcome back.
Hi there.
Tell us what's going on in Atlanta for you now and what things are like for you as you wait out this storm.
Oh, well, it's just bated breath waiting game here. My house, I don't have any word on. My parents' house in Southport is being monitored by their neighbors, and they've got about an inch or two of water in the garage. But other than that, it seems like it's fine. My boyfriend's house in Leland seems like it's fine. But we don't know anything about what's going on with my house because all of my neighbors evacuated. We do know that the dam on the biggest lake at Boiling Spring Lakes breached either yesterday morning or the evening before. So
yeah,
there clearly was a lot of water there, and there are a lot of lakes there as well. So we'll see which ones held.
How are you staying in touch with people, and who are you communicating with?
Through cell phones mostly. My boyfriend's tower went down he wasn't able to get any data on his phone, so he could make phone calls, but he couldn't see anything online. So I was helping update him a little bit just by reading the news here. But down in Southport, everyone still has cell data there. So
I wonder what it's like for you. I can hear the uncertainty and the hesitation in your voice being far away, being in a place like Atlanta and trying to monitor a situation like this over which you have absolutely no control. I mean, people who are there have no control, but you can't see it. What's it like for you to try to get information about the storm and, you know, be in a place like Atlanta while this is happening?
I don't even know how to describe it. It's, you know, it's out of my hands, so I can't really worry about it too much because there's nothing I can do. But the threat isn't over yet. Things are still going on. Things are still, dams are still breaching. It's still raining in some places, and it's really scary. I'll give you that.
Those are some of the voices we heard from our two-hour live Hurricane Florence special. That was back in September. You heard Kristen Cook, who evacuated her home in Boiling Spring Lakes to Atlanta, Georgia during the hurricane. And before that, licensed professional counselor Lonnie Crum. Today we're taking a look back at some of the best from the year as seen by Laura Pelliser, her favorite conversations from 2018. The other big, of course, ongoing story that we've been covering extensively is Silent Sam.
Yes, as you remember, not that long ago, we had Board of Governors member, UNC Board of Governors member Tom Goolsbee on the program. That was very interesting. We've featured a number of really fascinating guests who've been able to give us different angles to the Silent Sam story. And one of the guests who we've had on multiple times, who's really at the heart of the debate over Silent Sam, is activist and UNC graduate student Maya Little. So back in May, you know, Maya poured red paint mixed with some of her own blood onto the statue. Moments later, she was arrested. She came into our studio wearing those same pants, and I saw that there were little specks of red paint on there.
Let's listen to some of our conversation with activist and UNC Chapel Hill graduate student Maya Little from August of this year.
When we talk about the monument at UNC, this movement has been 50 years in the making, and there have been so many protests of students, black student activists, and workers and community members against this statue and against white supremacy at UNC. And the administration has never responded. When students have said, we're in pain, this statue is causing us direct harm. The people who gather around this statue are dangerous and they call for us to be lynched. The university didn't respond. The only time the university has responded has been to harass, surveil, and target anti-racist activists, to condemn them, to call us outside agitators, to deny that this movement's taking place.
Well, the university, and in particular Chancellor Carol Folt, will say her hands are tied. The legislature said she can't take that thing down. She's responsible for the safety and therefore the of students, and she can't take it down, so there's nothing she can do.
I mean, that's completely wrong because, for one, there have been countless people who have offered her solutions. I mean, the governor of the state, Roy Cooper, said that she can take it down as a public safety risk, which in the wake of Charlottesville and Nazis marching in the streets to defend these statues and murdering people, it's definitely a public safety risk. I mean, and again, Chancellor Folt has taken action. Chancellor Folt has taken action to silence protest. Chancellor Folt has taken action to protect Silent Sam. The university spent almost $400,000 to keep that statue on our campus, and now it's gone. So to say that they don't act, I completely disagree with. They act to silence.
What do you say to people who will say, look, that is not a monument to white supremacy. It is not a monument in defense of slavery. It is a monument to a way of life and a culture, and that while there have been active demonstrations protesting, there are an awful lot of people who feel equally strongly that that represents a way of life and they have a right to memorialize that in a public space.
Well, I would ask them, where would they put the statue of the people that sold their ancestors' children? Where would they put the statue of the people who enslaved and murdered their ancestors? Where would they put the statue dedicated and built by the people who didn't want them at this university, who would have lynched them? I would ask them that. And as in regards to the meanings of Silent Sam, it's very clear. I mean, it was christened by a story, a boast about beating a black woman who fled to campus actually for safety. I mean, The chancellor at the time, Francis Venable, said this is not a monument, a memorial to dead soldiers. This is a monument to the noble ideal. And that noble ideal is to uphold this racial hierarchy that was created by the white landowning class force poor white Southerners, who in fact deserted at an incredibly high rate. North Carolina at one point had the highest desertion rate in the Confederacy. To trick them into believing that this way of life, which is built on a racial caste system, which involved the enslavement and brutalization of black people, their disenfranchisement into the 20th century, is the Southern way. And that's not the Southern way. We have quite a bit of resistance, histories of resistance in this state and throughout the South. Histories of resistance to white supremacy, people standing up and fighting back against that. Why don't we honor those histories?
That is some of my conversation with activist and UNC grad student Maya Little from earlier this year. I'm here with State of Things producer Laura Pelliser talking about the stories that stand out for her in 2018. Now, there have been significant updates since then in this conversation, right?
There have, yes. It's important to note that the UNC Chapel Hill Board of Trustees, they did take action. Maya Little was there speaking about how they weren't taking any action. They did propose that the statue should sit in a $5.3 million history center on campus. The Board of UNC Board of Governors rejected that idea, of course, and their new deadline to come up with a plan for the statue is March 15th.
State of Things producer Laura Pelliser sharing her picks for standout segments of 2018. There's more just ahead on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio talking with State of Things producer Laura Pelliser about her favorite conversations from this past year. So where are we going next?
Can we talk about spiders?
Let's.
Can we do it? I feel like last year we were here doing a deep dive into the world of ants.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be remiss if we didn't do the same thing when it came to our favorite arachnids.
Yeah.
Right. So I wanted to talk about Eleanor Spicer Rice. She is this incredible entomologist who we had the pleasure of having on the show this year and last year. This year she came out with her book, Dr. Eleanor's Book of Common Ants. Of common spiders rather. And she just takes us into their world.
Yeah, but the thing is, with the ants, she loved the ants. Turns out she's terrified of spiders, right? Yeah,
hate spiders. She essentially lied, I would say, lied by omission, to the researcher who she paired up with to write her book. He is a spider celebrity scientist. And mm-hmm. she didn't want to tell him that she was essentially petrified of spiders.
All right, well, let's listen to a clip from entomologist and author Eleanor Spicer Rice.
I've been terrified of spiders my whole life, so I can identify with everybody who freaks out whenever I tell them that I wrote a book about spiders.
And there's a pretty good story about how the book came to be written, because you really wouldn't have just decided to do this.
No, I would not have decided to do this at all. I wrote a book about common ants, and a man named Chris Buttle, who is an arachnologist at McGill University, read the book and said, you know, I'm glad we're clearing up these ant misconceptions. Let's do a spider book. And he's such a wonderful communicator. And he's kind of famous, and so in the spider world. And so I was too embarrassed to tell him that I was scared of spiders. So I just did it, just to do it.
And he kind of found out, didn't he?
He did find out, because when we were writing the book, if I would Google something to see what the spider was, I would scream because they freak me out. Some of them are scary looking.
They're scary looking, but it turns out, and we're going to get to the myths, they won't necessarily kill you.
No, they're very unlikely to kill you. In fact, you're more likely to die from being afraid of spiders than you are from being bitten by spiders. People I almost have run my car off the road before. People have run their cars off the road. They've set their houses on fire. They have gotten toxicity problems from insecticides trying to kill something that really will not hurt them most of the time.
Let's talk about the ones that will, and then we're going to get into some of the benefits, because there are so and the myths, of course. Black widow, everybody's afraid of the black widow spider. Mm-hmm. All right, so what can she do to me?
Right, so a black widow is first of all, they are maligned because they're not very aggressive. And you know the black widows because they have those big old booties, those big black shiny abdomens with a red hourglass or red markings on the bottoms. And if you see one, she'll flash that red at you. And red is a warning color for us to stay away. And they've done studies before where they've actually tried to get black widows to bite, and they've poked them, they have jabbed at them, and the only way they could get the black widows to bite is if they squeezed them, if the black widow really felt like her life was in danger. And when people get bitten, it's actually because oftentimes because they accidentally pressed against a black widow in some way, and she's defending herself. But in general, they're very, very shy. If they do bite you, they can make you very ill. They can make you have chills and vomiting and fever and stuff, but death is highly unlikely.
Do all spiders have some form of venom?
Yes, almost all spiders have some form of venom, but many spiders can't even pierce your skin, and most spiders don't bite unless it's a last resort.
Now, the recluse, the red recluse, is that
what I mean? The
brown recluse. I'm afraid of the red ones.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
have you
yeah.
ever seen one
if
of those?
If I ever see that red recluse.
They're from Mars.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Those right. rainbow ones, too, are kind of scary.
Tell me about the brown recluse.
The brown recluse is another one. God bless it. Everybody hates the brown recluse, and everybody thinks that they know somebody who's been bitten by a brown recluse, but many times, bites from brown recluses or people who are diagnosed as being bitten by a brown recluse, it's something else. So oftentimes, bacterial infections can cause cause your tissue to die, like you would think of as a spider bite, or insect bites or stings can cause reactions. And so people think that they've been bitten by brown recluses, but they never saw the spider.
That's entomologist Eleanor Spicer Rice speaking in a conversation recorded earlier this year. That interview is one of our producer Laura Pelliser's top picks for 2018. And you wanted to bring that conversation to our attention, not only because of Eleanor, but also because of where it takes place, right?
Yeah, every few months, you know, not all our listeners might know, but every few months we essentially head to the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. And my heart is leaping just thinking about it. I get so, so giddy when we go to this museum. Our studio that we record at is tucked away next to this extraordinarily cool deep water submersible. We've got Stumpy the whale, the skeletons of this incredible whale, and our studio is sort of nestled under that. So it is.
And I get my face on an IMAX screen.
And you get to go up in this IMAX dome,
come
and
on,
you know
cool.
we get to have our listeners kind of sit in this dome and see you on the big screen.
All right. Well, we go from spiders to surfing now. A lot of the outdoor life with Laura, as you moonlight as a summer surfer.
You do surf.
You're a surfer.
Yeah. Well, I started surfing quite a while ago. It's been a while. It's been about 10 years of a pretty bad surfing legacy. I'm a really bad surfer, but I'm committed to it in my own way.
Well, Maya Deary is also a surfer, and she appeared on our show because she's more than a surfer. She has been on a journey all of her life, and it was a fascinating conversation.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I have been trying to sneak surfing onto the program for a while, but I knew that, you know, I wouldn't just be able to convince you all to do a segment about the sport. Mm-hmm. I knew I would have to dig deeper and cover everything that has to do with surfing, the economics, racism and sexism ecology.
What do you do when the skag is busted off?
Exactly, exactly. So both the practical and the more nuanced aspects of the sport. And Maya Deary was the perfect person to cover all of these different elements.
We'll prove it right here. Maya Deary, founder of Waves to Wisdom, a surf trip and coaching program, also a longtime professor at Guilford College. Let's listen.
As I was facing 40, I suddenly realized that despite all of my expectations, I was, like everybody else, going to die someday, and I better think about what I wanted to do. And I didn't have to think very hard. It was this eminence that just came up out of me. You need to surf. And so I did research. I'm athletically the least gifted person that I know of, small, weak, not particularly adept. So I researched the easiest place to learn to surf, and I went there for surf camp for a week, and it was amazing. I think I stood up on two waves, one of which the instructor dragged me to my feet for, because he promised a picture of me standing up. But I was hooked.
And also, you're kind of among the older surfers in that group, right?
Yes, I think the average age was 12. The first night I wound up with six or seven little homesick girls in my tent because I was mom age.
Yeah. But you did learn to surf, and then you embraced it, and then these trips to the North Carolina coast and a sudden awakening about the fact that this is not just a thing on the way, an obstacle to my surfing, this land in between. It's a real place. And so you start taking people there. And then you start doing surf trips to Costa Rica.
Yes, absolutely. That was it came out of the presentation of a problem. Guilford had a January term for a while, and the first January term I took students to Bald Head Island, and I couldn't get them to go outside because it was so cold. So I thought, oh, I have to take them somewhere warm, and we need to surf just because I think it's going to be good for us and we can learn some hard things. And I had become obsessed with the history of surfing, so I knew all of these books that were really good windows into the way that surfing, like everything else, allows us to explore post-colonial dynamics and racial disparities and sexism and appropriation and so developed at first a class and then there was one semester long program where students learned to surf and then dealt with all of this difficult history. And I was able to ask them questions about what are you interested in and how can you apply it to this issue in ways that allow you to be able to envision a future for yourself.
Take us into that world. Tell us about that history.
Well, surfing, there's a lot we don't know about the history of surfing, but some things that we do know are that the Hawaiians were surfers. It was something that they did, and the Hawaiian grandmas surfed. Men surfed, women surfed, everybody did it. If the waves were good, everybody stopped work and went to them. And we know that there was surfing on the west coast of Africa in what is now Ghana. You played a clip, I believe, from The Endless Summer, the music. And those young men went in search of perfect waves. And from that film, there is a line that they were the first people to surf in Ghana. We know for a fact that that is not true. And so surfing was something that people of color
the white folks who went on The Endless Summer,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes. Robert August and Michael Hinson. And it was the movie was from 1964 is when they started filming it. So it was a product of its time. But looking into that history, I think, is illustrative of the challenges that we face. And you look at surfers now and they're disproportionately white males. And it's it's a place that is a little bit slow, I think, that space, that social space.
Well, talk about promoting surfing, too, as a sport, particularly in Hawaii, is, again, a way of whitewashing this thing that had been around forever and not necessarily the province of white men.
Sure, yeah. Well, the history of Hawaii is a repetition of a history that is unfolded over and over again, but there was a promoter, Alexander Hume Ford, who thought that surfing would be a good way to promote tourism in Hawaii. And so he essentially rewrote the history and ignored the Hawaiians who were still surfing and said that, that Hawaii is a place where men and boys can challenge nature and challenge the waves. And he acknowledged that Hawaiians had surfed, but essentially pretended like they were all gone and it was up to the white man to resurrect this noble sport.
So there's a clip from a State of Things conversation with Maya Deary, founder of Waves to Wisdom, a surf trip and coaching program, also a longtime professor at Guilford College. And I'm here with State of Things producer Laura Pelliser, who is sharing her top picks from 2018. So let's go to another Monday Meet conversation that stood out for you. Ray Barfield, who explores life, death, and spirituality as an everyday pediatric palliative care specialist at Duke Health. Fascinating guy.
Yeah, he really is. I mean, he is someone who is doing a lot. He does a lot of deep thinking every day about what it means to be a doctor and what it means to feel true empathy for your patients every day.
Let's hear a bit of our conversation with Ray Barfield.
There was a kid who was 15 or 16 years old, and he had been transferred to my institution for transplant for a relapsed bone cancer that he had, Ewing sarcoma. And I came in the room. I could tell he was afraid. And he was very quiet. And so I sat down and I introduced myself. I said, my name's Ray, and you can call me Ray if you want to. We have a lot to talk about, but I'm interested in learning one thing about you that has nothing to do with your cancer. And so he pulled out a coin and started doing magic tricks for me. And it turned out that the guy was an astonishing magician. And he and I would use the language of magic and magic tricks as a way to open up difficult conversations. And we were able to go to some places I think he had never gone before in conversations. And ultimately, he ended up dying. But we were able to talk about his dying, in part because we connected at a different level, just around magic. And I was just curious at the time, what are you interested in? But when he opened himself up and showed me the thing that he cared the most about, we connected as human beings. And that gave me a flavor of the kind of thing that I wanted to learn more about.
You also had an experience with parents, again, a young man who is approaching the age of 18, whose cancer had gotten fairly serious, and there was a kind of disconnect between the family and the patient on this, right?
I know who you're talking about. This was actually a kid with Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, and he was in the late stages of it, and his heart was failing. The perception of the entire team, his cardiologist, and even the palliative care physician who had been asked to see him, was that he had no idea that he was dying. And so when I came on service, I went to his mom, and his mom said, that's right, he has no idea that he's dying, and we're going to keep it that way. So I asked her why. I said, tell me more about what your thinking is. And she said, Dr. Ray, he is the most joyful person I've ever known. And if he's moving towards the end of his life, I would rather him have the last part of his life lived with joy than with the terror that I know he'll have if we talk to him about dying. So it was a big disconnect between the way that we were all thinking about what we should do with a 17-year-old about to turn, you know, 18 and become an adult, and what his mom was thinking.
So now, so there's, you're thinking, no, we really should tell him, right? And, but you think as a team, he doesn't know. Mom thinks he doesn't know. You think he should. What happens next?
Well, one of the things that I've learned from parents, they've taught me to remember that when a child is dying, one of the things that means is that the only parenting that this parent's going to get to do is whatever happens in the last weeks and months of their child's life. They're not going to get to parent the child through marriage, through college, through grandkids, through all the crises that happen. This is it. This is their only parenting. And once that very simple insight hit me, I realized how presumptuous it was of me to take away this part of their parenting. And so, even though I wanted him to know, that was kind of my baseline, she was telling me as his parent, I don't want him to know. So what happened is this. I told her, with her permission, I asked her, I said, you know, I want to respect that, and I will. I do have a worry. Would it be all right with you if I share what that worry is? And she said, okay. And I said, in my experience, sometimes children, when they know their parents are afraid and they know their parents are sad, they want to protect their parents. So they may know a lot more than they're letting on to because they know that you're scared. So what worries me is if a child does know they're dying and they're afraid, but they don't feel like they can talk to anyone, then they're alone. They're alone in their fear. That's the thing that worries me. So she heard that, and she loved this kid. So she started crying, and she said, well, then I don't know what to do because I want him to be joyful, but of course I don't want him to be alone in fear if he does know more than he's letting on. So what I offered to do, I said, you know, I'll go talk to him. And I promised her, I said, I will not take him down these roads you don't want him to go. I will respect your wishes. But I'll try to probe gently and see if maybe there's more there than we think. She gave me permission to do that. The people who had talked with him before had also asked him a lot of open-ended questions, mostly about himself. They'd asked, are you worried about anything? Do you have any questions? And he had always said no. He was always playing his video games, kept his eyes glued to the TV. No questions. No, I'm not worried about anything. I'm good. So I went in with the advantage of knowing what they had asked and decided to ask a different kind of question. I sat down with him and I said, I just had this wonderful conversation with your mom. She really loves you. And he's sitting there with his video game. Oh, yeah. Yeah, she loves me. And I asked him questions about her instead of himself. Do you think she ever worries over anything? Oh, yeah. She worries. Well, what does she worry about? Well, she worries about me dying.
That's my conversation with Ray Barfield from earlier this year, an oncologist and pediatric palliative care specialist at Duke Health. Thank you for your hard work. Our conversation will continue. There is more just ahead with Laura Pelliser, a producer on The State of Things, sharing her picks for 2018. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, looking back at 2018 with State of Things producer Laura Pelliser. So let's talk about one last meet that stood out for you, Jesse Hamilton McCoy II.
Jesse Hamilton McCoy II. This man is an absolute gem of a person. I think one of the fun things about producing meets is that you get to have this very intimate conversation with someone. You almost feel like they're your friend mm-hmm. by the end of spending 1 hour, 2 hours in this pre-interview. He is such a ball of energy. He is so passionate. He is so hardworking. He is extraordinarily dedicated to what he does, which is working as a housing lawyer in Durham, helping people avoid evictions, essentially.
Well, let's listen to a clip of our conversation with Durham-based lawyer Jesse Hamilton McCoy II. Here he's talking about encounters with police, and those interactions started him, in fact, on the path to becoming a lawyer.
In middle school, I had my first run-ins with police. Some were very positive run-ins and some were very negative. But as with anything, the negative tends to stick out a lot greater than the positive. One such instance was when I was coming back with a friend from getting groceries. We used to go to the grocery store on Saturdays for our moms to get whatever that they needed us to get from their list. And when we were coming back with our hands full of groceries, a police car pulls up, cuts on the siren, stops us. Police gets out the car, asks us why we were throwing rocks in the road. Now, keep in mind, our hands were full of groceries. Mm-hmm. We weren't throwing rocks. We naturally believed that maybe he was confused and he thought it was somebody else and he just confuses. But quickly, it escalated to the point where we were being stuffed in the back of a car. And we thought we were going to be arrested, but we weren't arrested. He just rode around with the sirens going off until there was a nice crowd of people in the neighborhood and then opened the door and let us out with a stern warning about don't do this anymore. Don't throw rocks. And it was one of those situations where you could see the look of shame on everybody's face. And it was so misplaced. We felt like we wanted to take a stand against what this officer did to us, but you don't really have any mechanism to do that. You can't, you know, curse out the officer, certainly, and you don't want to do it in a crowd of people. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, it was one of those things where it felt like we were supposed to accept that this was the way it was going to be. But I remember that feeling, and I knew from what other people had told me from their run-ins that this wasn't the first time, and there was a growing sentiment of people who felt voiceless against law enforcement wrongs and law enforcement overstepping on their rights and abilities. And I said to myself, you know, I want to be in a position when I grow up where I can actually represent this community. I can actually stand up and voice this community, stand up to bad law enforcement officers. And this is not against the good law enforcement officers. We love you guys. But for bad law enforcement officers to actually stand up against them and expose what they're doing and equalize the playing field, so to speak. And so that was really when I shifted my career decision from being a doctor to one to be an attorney. And that was only the first. I had another run-in later on when I was in high school, and I was working for an anesthesiologist in a health professions partnership initiative program at UNC. And I had an officer from Chapel Hill Police Department who came and found me walking into the McNider building behind Health Sciences Library and actually slammed me into the brick wall of the Health Sciences Library, saying that I looked suspicious and I must have been stealing computers, which I had nothing but breakfast in my hand. And it wasn't even my breakfast. It was the breakfast I was bringing back from the doctor who sent me to go get it. So that was a big deal. The doctor was livid. The coordinator of the program was livid. And at the time, I don't think I really understood the gravity of what had happened because I was so accustomed to these kinds of things happen.
That is Durham-based lawyer Jesse Hamilton McCoy II fighting unjust evictions in Durham County, and one of the conversations that stood out for producer Laura Pelliser. And today, Jesse's actually working as a housing lawyer.
Right. So he is the James Scott Farron Lecturing Fellow at Duke Law. He's also the supervising attorney for the Duke Law Civil Justice Clinic. And he runs this eviction program that aims to reduce the number of people who are forced out of their homes in Durham County, which really is a very significant problem as the city is, Durham itself is changing right before our eyes.
As Jesse points out, it's not just a problem for the tenants, it's a problem for landlords too. It doesn't really help them to evict people and go for a month or two without rent as they make this transition. So working on ways to help people pay the rent, stay in the house, is actually good for the landlords as well. Let's listen to this clip from Jesse McCoy II talking about his work in fighting evictions in Durham.
There's a guy by the name of Charles Holton who had launched a civil justice clinic at Duke University with the goal being to provide students with an experiential experience of litigation. Like, these are advanced level law students who wanted to see what it's like to be a litigator. And I was one of the attorneys that those students would work with. And part of working with me is I'm very, like I told you before, I'm very people oriented. Mm-hmm. So if somebody tells me that they have an issue going on at their house, well, we need to go to the house. We need to see the issue. We need to take pictures of the issue. And a lot of the times, those involve cases that were public housing. So students who may come from more privileged backgrounds and have never been exposed to any kind of public housing would get in the car with me and ride over to the other side of town and go into public housing units. And I think it was good for two main reasons. Reason number one is it educated them about what people are dealing with outside of some of the concerns that the students may primarily have. So students, you know, as a student, you're concerned about, your career path and your options moving forward professionally. But there are people out here who are concerned about how are they going to eat tomorrow? Like, how are they going to live? So that's one thing. On the other side, as a native of Durham County, it gives me tremendous joy to be able to bring legal acumen to people who otherwise would not have a voice. And these students are amazing. So bringing these students over always gave my clients a sense of pride. Like, I have a Duke person working on my case.
Who has seen a cockroach. How about that?
Right. There's a Duke person who's advocating for me. And there's a sense of validation that came from, you know, knowing that, you know, this attorney and this Duke law student are investigating my claim.
Structurally, does the word get out among the landlords? Look, we can't get away with this stuff anymore. Do things kind of change systemically within the system, knowing that the marshal's in town?
Well, it's an interesting thing. We've had, as part of our awareness campaign, we've met with a lot of different landlord groups. And what we're realizing is there's definitely, landlords are definitely not a monolith. Right. So there are some landlords who they come to every meeting. They present legitimate concerns. They say, you know, we have to evict because if I'm trying to expand to be able to provide low-income housing to other communities, I need money to be able to float that capital to acquire this other property. And if I don't get it, this out-of-state corporation is going to get it, who's not worried about low-income housing or the community or whatever the case may be. But at the same time, I can't be in a position where I don't get paid the rent because then it messes up what I'm trying to finance. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, the landlords who are the problematic ones, they're not coming to the meetings, right? Mm-hmm. And because of the demographic that they serve, they may not necessarily feel they need to. So some of the things that we used to hear were particularly landlords who serve a Spanish-speaking demographic have threatened to call ICE if anybody presents an issue about any of the conditions that are going on in the unit. So nobody says anything.
Housing lawyer Jesse Hamilton McCoy II talking about the challenges some tenants face in Durham, North Carolina. Conversation is one of State of Things producer Laura Pelliser's favorites from 2018. Music, big part of the State of Things.
Music, yes. So Friday mornings are fun and chaotic and stressful and everything else. Fridays are when we do our music segment. We ask our bands to please, please, please arrive at 10:30 a.m. That is hard for a lot of bands to wake up that early.
Because in band years, that is actually midnight.
Right, exactly. It's very confusing for some folks to set their alarm that early. But it's a lot of fun. And I just feel that, you know, Friday mornings have this certain energy to them. I have witnessed some very interesting things in my time here on a Friday morning. I've witnessed a gentleman playing two saxes at once. Mm-hmm. I have seen someone tuning a drum, a leather drum, out in the hallway on an electric stove that they brought in. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you spotted that.
Oh, right? Yeah. It gets it tempered.
Exactly. And then Valerie June was absolutely such a beautiful character. She's a singer-songwriter. She is from Tennessee, and she was such a pleasure to have on.
I will have to say, well, I'm going to play this clip in a minute, and we're going to hear the music for our neighbors here at American Tobacco, because we share the space with the news department. Sometimes not as charming for them as they listen to some of these particularly rock bands kind of warm up and get mic'd. You know, it can be distracting if you're actually trying to write a story.
Right.
But it's a lot of fun for us. So
there's nothing like, you know, a man playing two saxes for half an hour as they're trying to get your scripts done or get on air. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, this is a conversation with singer-songwriter Valerie June. Let's listen.
You know, any time that you have any worries or stress on you, the best thing to do is just catch that sunset or the sunrise, and it'll help you to get rid of it or to pass it on, you know, or to walk through it versus getting rid of it. Maybe you need to sit with it and watch that sunset.
You might need to stay with it a little longer and not get rid of it. Yeah. But what about, and also I think there's something that can happen to be inspired by the natural world, waterways, the sounds of the natural world.
Is that
a big part of your music writing?
Well, I do love to just spend some days in silence many times and just listen to what's happening around me.
Literally days in silence?
I used to spend weeks in silence. I would get all the groceries I needed and I would tell my friends and my family, hey, I'm going into silence for the week. And they would know that I wasn't being rude if they ran across me and I was just being quiet, because I needed sometimes to rest my voice because I used it a lot for my work and life. And then I also need sometimes just to listen to the world and hear, you know, sirens or birds or waterfalls or whatever it might be, and to let that be the inspiration many times as well.
Will you do another song for us?
I sure will. This one is for, I always say, for all the goddesses that are out there, because there's a lot of beautiful women who are all working hard to make this earth as powerful and wonderful as it is. So, this song's called The Working Woman Blues, and it's for all the beautiful goddesses that are there. My grandmother, my mother, my great friends, the women who are working here, they're all around. So just take a moment and think about them and send them a little bit of love.
Well, that's a clip from Nashville-based singer-songwriter Valerie June. Our conversation from earlier this year, one of producer Laura Pelliser's top picks for 2018. What stood out for you?
Valerie June is an extraordinarily special person. I would say that I am someone who veers a little bit more towards skepticism and not as much towards spirituality, but the way that Valerie June speaks about spirituality is so concrete and so matter of fact that it just makes sense. You know, her connection with waterways, she was telling me in the pre-interview about how when she needs to process anything in her life, she simply walks down to a stream or a river. She has really special encounters there. Maybe someone walks up to her and tells her a story that gives her some sort of epiphany. And that's sort of just how she lives her life, with this openness that the world is trying to tell her something, and that she hopefully will be able to translate that message into a song.
As I'm sure you have gathered as a listener, if you've listened for this past hour, there's a lot of intensity that goes into producing these programs and talking with the people who are on the show every day. And to be able to stick with it the way you have, to bring the same intensity you do day after day, not get burned out, not get, in fact, actually ask for more, running toward the gunfire, as it were. Embracing the intensity that is the show is what makes us great. So thank you, Laura Pelliser, for another great year.
Thank you so much, Frank. It was a pleasure.
Laura Pelliser is a producer on The State of Things. You can find out, actually you can get links to her picks at her website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by other people as well. Anita Rao, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley's our technical director, and North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.